Hello, listeners. Been wondering how you can help the show? Probably not. But here are five things you can do. 1. Subscribe. Support the show by clicking the subscription link in the show notes. 2. Review on iTunes, on our website, www.afraidofnothingpodcast.com, or on whatever app you listen to. 3. Donate. When you go to our website, click the cute coffee cup icon. Or, in the show notes, click the subscription link. 4. Share. Sharing really is caring. Tell your friends, and even your enemies, to check out the show. 5. Watch. Wait a minute. It's a podcast, not a movie. Actually, it's both. Check the show notes to find out where to watch the documentary. You can also rent it on Prime Video. That's it. Oh, one last thing. Enjoy this episode.
When I was about 5 or 6 years old, I was taken, and they, instead of taking me as they normally would, they took me in the backyard of my grandparents' house. And I, you know, remember feeling the cold, wet grass under my feet. And I remember it was very dark out and I was cold. And they showed me what we call a screen memory. And you might have heard this from other abductees, where it's like wearing VR goggles because it looks so real. Mm. But at that time, we didn't have anything like that to compare it to. And they showed me my family being marched out into the backyard, walked out, and there's a clothesline down the middle of the yard. And my family was on the other side of the clothesline from me. And they said, "You have to be good. You cannot talk about this. You have to be quiet. If you talk about this, we will kill your family." And they sprayed something on the backs of their necks, and my family was beheaded in front of me.
Oh, God. Huh.
And then they took me back to my room, and I was just a little kid. After that, you know, shortly after that, I just had a breakdown where I couldn't take it anymore. I felt trapped. They found me at school, huddled in the corner of a bathroom stall, holding on my knees, just rocking. I wouldn't speak. I wouldn't get up. I wouldn't move. They had to call my mom. She came and got me and talked me out of the bathroom. And I just kept saying, they want them to stop. I want them to stop taking me. I want them to stop touching me. I'm afraid.
In a world where nothing is known, nothing is certain. Reality is not real. Wake up! Be afraid of nothing. I'm Bob Heskey.
Robert.
The host with the ghost.
This is my podcast, based on my paranormal documentary, Afraid of Nothing. Each episode, we talk to people who see life and the afterlife through a different lens. Join me.
Who is this large man? And what's he doing in our bedroom?
As we lift the veil and open our minds to see beyond our eyes lie. This is Afraid of Nothing.
Nothing.
Karen Wilkinson is the author of Stolen Seed, Evil Harvest. She is a regular writer contributor to L.A. Marzulli's monthly newsletter, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. Karen is a wife, mother, and grandmother. She worked on the software industry for many years before leaving to raise her family. Karen says, "For as early as I can remember, I have been abducted by non-human alien entities, possibly hundreds of times. I have seen many UAPs, UFOs, throughout my lifetime, and suffered emotional and physical ailments and had surgeries due to the things they did to me. I pray that I can utilize my experiences to glorify God, to share the truth, and to help others in any way I can." I am here with a pretty amazing guest. Her name is Karen Wilkinson, and her story is, well, it's a bit of a tough one that she's had to go through, but it's other people have had it, and this is really a side of the alien abduction story you may not hear a lot about. So welcome to the show, Karen.
Oh, thank you so much, Robert. I am just so happy to be here with you. It's an honor to be on your show.
Same here. I really appreciate having you. You have an interesting story,
and an interesting take on the alien abduction, which you've captured in a book called Stolen Seed, Evil Harvest. Now, we're going to go into your story in a minute, but do you mind just giving us the main story beats about what compelled you to write this book? And if someone was going to buy it, what might they learn from it?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. So the book Stolen Seed, Evil Harvest, it is an account of my lifetime of experiences with non-human, what some people call alien entities, and what happened to me throughout that time and how I was able to stop it. And I wrote the book because after doing an interview with L.A. Marzulli a few years ago, he put me into his fourth movie, which was on the UFO abductions. And so I started talking to so many people. I realized they had a lot more information to share and they were wanting to hear that information. So this book was a way for me to share that information.
You know, it's funny. You even hear in the military, some people say that you mentioned non-human entities versus aliens. You do hear about whispers of some people in the U.S. government who call them demons. And so I think maybe if your thought process is that these non-human entities could be fallen angels, is that an accurate description?
Yes, that's quite accurate. I believe that they are fallen angels, and that I also believe, and I've written extensively on this, I wrote in the book and for L.A. Marzulli's monthly newsletter about the shorter grays, the ones that people tend to see in their homes. Those, I believe, are inhabited by demons, as opposed to demonic, which fallen angels would fall under that category. And I think my friend Vicki Joy Anderson explained that much in depth when you spoke with her. I don't know if anyone might remember that.
I hope they do. That was a great episode. And we talked before we hit record that you two are good friends. And yeah, she had a lot about sleep paralysis, but her thing was about you just think when you wake up and you see the shadow figure, but that's just the last part of the movie. There's a whole bunch before that happens in your subconscious. And she had a interesting take on sleep paralysis, as you do tonight in non-human alien entity. So I think we're going to get right into it. I mean, there have been a couple stages, I believe, in your life. There was the early days where you had these experiences and you didn't quite know what to do about them. And then you were kind of reintroduced to your faith a little bit, or at least a building block for it. And then later on, you had some therapy that helped you learn how to use your religion really as a tool to help combat the non-human entities and to make your life probably more pleasant and to put a shield up against it. So if that's accurate, I would like to start with the early days first.
Yes, that's pretty accurate. And yeah, I can fill in the blanks as we go along. But the early days for me, you know, my youngest, earliest memories were of being taken by these entities and the difficulties therein being so little, not knowing who and what they were, not having vocabulary to tell people what was happening to me, having no idea that it didn't happen to everyone else, and then being threatened by these entities that if I did talk to someone, they were going to harm my family. So it put me as a small child in a very precarious situation, not only not having vocabulary, but being afraid then to share that information.
Yeah, that's horrifying. And did you not even try to mention it to your family, or did you try and were just kind of told you're just dreaming or imagining it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I did try it. You know, I tried to talk to them after I would be taken, and let me know if you want me to go through a typical scenario for me of being taken, because I can certainly do that.
That would be great. And you know what? There might be a couple scenarios, because it, correct me if I'm wrong, but most people think like the ship and they pull you through the walls, but there's also stories of being taken underground. So I'd love for you to cover both tracks or however you want, but I'd love to hear both sides of that story.
Okay, great. Yeah, that kind of lays a foundation for us for the rest of it. So when I was little, when these started, and it continued this way throughout my life, I would feel a change in the room at night. It would usually happen in the middle of the night, most commonly, not always. And I would feel the presence before everything even started. And to this day, it's a feeling that is so hard to describe that I can't give you a very specific way, but I can still feel it when they're around. I would feel them, their presence. There would be sometimes a light coming through the window or through another window down the hall from a different room. And there would be this low hum, this low vibration that would get lower and lower. It was like holding on to a bass speaker, that kind of thumping, and it just kind of filled my body. And I would notice somewhere in the room, not always in the same place, sometimes in a corner, in a doorway, at the foot of the bed, hovering above me or beside me, would be at least two or more of these small gray, typical gray alien entities that most people identify with when you talk about UFOs and aliens. They were about 3 feet tall, very large heads with a very small spindly neck, very frail looking bodies. They had huge black eyes that just looked like screens. The eyes didn't seem to be really eyes. They just seemed like a lens, like they didn't move.
Huh.
They just had like a slit where the mouth would be and where the nose would be. And they never spoke. They spoke with through your mind. So they spoke at, you know, to you through my mind. Some of them did not smell very good. Sometimes they would come with a very musky, sulfury, almost urine, excrement, maybe dead animal kind of smell, just a combination of things. Not like anything else I've ever smelled. I've smelled that smell many times on them. And some of them didn't smell so bad. So it was weird that sometimes they had a worse smell than others. But I think I have a lot of theories on that. And I believe that these entities that they send to get people are just kind of their boots on the ground, biological suits that are created to come and collect people. Just because they didn't have any functioning eyes or mouths that I could see. They were very frail. I think some of them smelled bad because maybe they were older. Maybe they were going bad, for lack of a better word. I know it sounds strange, but you know, I've tried to wrap my head around why some smelled so bad. And they were just, they had this evil air about them. You just could feel it. Just, it's like looking at a rattlesnake, you know, you just, there was nothing nice or positive about them. And they would just be, you know, look at me, or, you know, just not even say anything, and just, or you're fine, you're okay, but never with any compassion, very just flat. But at that point, these entities would levitate me. I would get to a point where I was awake. And as soon as that, I recognized that they were there, they would put my body in a state of paralysis. And I call it waking paralysis. I've had sleep paralysis many times. This is very different because I was fully awake at the time. And sometimes I would wet the bed, you know, things like that, because I was so scared. And all these physical things that were happening that I was very aware of. But I couldn't move my body at that point. I couldn't scream out for anyone. If I did have time to yell out, if there was a sibling in the room or parents in the next room, they wouldn't wake up. You know, it was like they were put into a very deep sleep state. And even later in life, when I would be with a partner, a husband, they also would be in that same deep sleep state where I could not rouse them. Mm-hmm. Before I go on, do you have any questions about that part so far?
No, I was going to actually, I think you covered it. I was going to ask if there are other people in the room. And you are married now, right? I believe, correct?
Yes, I am.
And actually have grandchildren?
Yes, I do. Yes. Loves of my life.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it must be hard dating to find somebody to, I mean, and do I tell them? And, you know, third, fourth date, if I sleep over, you know, if the lights go on, it's just so you know what that is. I mean, that must have been really weighed on your mind beyond just happening to you, but in social aspects as well, I would imagine.
You know, it did, but it's certainly not something you open with. And it's not something that I talked about, because I was taught from a very, very young age not to talk about this. When I was about 5 or 6 years old, I was taken, and they, instead of taking me as they normally would, they took me in the backyard of my grandparents' house. And I, you know, remember feeling the cold, wet grass under my feet. And I remember it was very dark out and I was cold. And they showed me what we call a screen memory. And you might have heard this from other abductees, where it's like wearing VR goggles because it looks so real. Mm. But at that time, we didn't have anything like that to compare it to. And they showed me my family being marched out into the backyard, walked out, and there's a clothesline down the middle of the yard, and my family was on the other side of the clothesline from me. And they said, you have to be good. You cannot talk about this. You have to be quiet. If you talk about this, we will kill your family. And they sprayed something on the backs of their necks, and my family was beheaded in front of me.
Oh, God.
And then they took me back to my room. And I was just a little kid. And from that point on, and I know that's a typical tactic I've since learned when people abduct children for other trafficking and things like that.
Yeah.
So now it makes a little more sense to me, you know, that psychologically they're protecting themselves from me saying anything to anyone. I wasn't about to let harm come to the people I loved. You know, I learned that lesson very early. And after that, you know, shortly after that, I just had a breakdown where I couldn't take it anymore. I felt trapped. They found me at school, huddled in the corner of a bathroom stall, holding on my knees, just rocking. I wouldn't speak. I wouldn't get up. I wouldn't move. They had to call my mom. She came and got me and talked me out of the bathroom. And I just kept saying, they want them to stop. I want them to stop taking me. I want them to stop touching me. I'm afraid. So she took me to the doctor and she said, I think someone's doing something to her because this is what she's saying. And he examined me. And, you know, I had bruises and cuts and things. Every little kid does.
Yep.
And he said, well, clearly she's traumatized. Whatever happens, she's young, she'll forget. Now, that seems very crass, but this was in the 60s and early 70s. You have to remember, it was a different time back then.
Yes, unfortunately, that's my time, too. I'm the same.
Yeah. You know, it's not something you'd probably hear now, but you might. You just don't know. It depends on who you're going to. But at that point in time, he didn't. You know, he didn't have anything concrete to go on, and I couldn't say he was doing it. So, you know, they just tried to keep a closer eye on me at school. Well, that's not where the problems were.
Sounds like they're grooming you, and was there like one of the entities that was your main stage manager or handler or whatever you want to say that would kind of help you out?
Yes, absolutely. You hit that nail on the head. They were grooming me and they were teaching me how to, you know, follow their rules and be good. And, you know, when that E.T. movie came out, not only could I not watch it, but every time I heard that be good thing, it just freaked me out.
Because
I, you know, yeah. For different reasons, because that was supposed to be cutesy. I was with some friends. We went to see that movie. I got up and left right away and made an excuse that I was sick. I freaked out. I cried in the bathroom while they sat in there and watched the movie, you know, and just, it was terrible for me. And before cell phones, I couldn't call my parent, you know, parents, I didn't want to upset anyone, but, and I didn't want to tell anyone, but I had what I call in the book, I call him my handler. I call him that because that's the best way to describe him. There was a man, he appeared as a man who was with me for my entire life that they were taking me. He had a name that wasn't a name we spoke. It was like an imprint.
Yeah.
Like a mental imprint. So maybe like animals kind of do with each other. I always knew him. When I was little, I called him Toby, but it wasn't really his name. I just gave him that name.
Did he have indifference or like hate like the other gray aliens? Did you get the sense that he was someone you could trust, or was he just the best one option to trust?
He was the only option.
Okay.
He was my only option. So it wasn't like I had a choice to say, well, I don't like you. Send me another one. You know, I mean, and as a little kid, I was like, well, this particular one, you know, while he's taking me to different rooms or different places when I'm here and instructing me, he's not physically hurting me at the moment. And I definitely got a Stockholm syndrome type relationship with him because he was there to collect me when I was brought to the facilities that I was taken to. He would, you know, take me back when we were done and, you know, or sometimes, not always, because a lot of times I wouldn't remember the return. And I developed that kind of a relationship with him, which changed over time.
And did you go to a ship or did you go underground? Because one of the interesting things I thought I heard on other podcasts is a lot of people think you go up into a spaceship in the sky, but a lot of people don't realize there's a lot of underground tunnels and things that we're not even aware of where a lot of activity takes place. Is that accurate?
Right. That is very accurate. Yes, I was, you know, the ships were used for transport to get us, and I say us because there were many other abductees around from point A to point B. What I remember very clearly would be from my youngest memories would be waking up from the stupor, because once they would take me, I would go from the waking paralysis state to a sleep state and wake up usually standing at this bank of like elevator doors, and we would get in these elevators. At that point, I'd still be with the little smelly grays, And it would just go down and down and down. And then we would get on what I called when I was little, and I called them this for so long, the sideways elevators, because they went sideways or some up at an angle or down at an angle very quickly. But these had benches in them. And, you know, for me, when I was little, vehicles made noise. You know, every vehicle made noise, trains, cars, what have you. And these were silent, and they seemed very fast, but very silent and very smooth. And now I realize that must have been some sort of like a high speed rail or tram or transport system.
Yeah. Hey, one quick question before we talk about what's underground. Time, because it seems like, you know, is time different from normal time? Because it seems like it could take 8-10 hours. And then you sometimes I would imagine you'd only be gone a few hours. So
right.
Is time different when these abductions occur?
Yeah, it definitely did seem different. And I don't have any accurate way to gauge how long I was there versus how much time passed at home. You know, I didn't have a cell phone. We didn't have those then. I didn't have my own little watch or anything to wear, and nothing to gauge the time frames. But it would seem like I was gone for so long, you know, and then I would get home and it was still nighttime, because when I would be brought back, I would wake up back in my bed. Sometimes my pajamas would be inside out. Sometimes they would be in another room altogether, or sometimes I'd be dropped off in a different room at the house, and I would be scared. So I would go and I would crawl under my parents' bed because I was so scared. And I thought maybe that would be a safe place to sleep, anywhere that I could find someone else in someone else's room, but not wake them up, because I didn't want to risk getting in trouble from these entities by ringing any alarm bells. So I have no idea to know how much time went by, but it didn't ever seem to match up quite right. And there were times during the day where I would not have vivid memories of the abduction, but I would be somewhere and all of a sudden I'm like a minute earlier. And I know everything that's going to happen, whether I was in a classroom or in a public setting or at home and there was a TV show on or cooking or whatever. And it was more than deja vu, knowing, you know, exactly what's going to happen for the next minute.
Yeah, a premonition, precog.
But yeah, so time was definitely a very interesting factor throughout this. But the funny thing about time, and I learned this during my near-death experience as well, is we just experience time in such a linear format. And that is just so unique to us in our lives in this earth. And we then kind of expect everything else to fit into our little linear time format. And it really doesn't. You know, nothing else seemed to fit into this. So we just think we're the apex predator and everything works the way it works in our world. And it, you know, it, and I've learned that it really doesn't.
So it almost sounds like it's a, almost like a second underground school you're going through with these abductions, and they're grooming you for something. Underground, was it just aliens and different types of aliens or non-human entities? Or did you ever see government people? Like, was there a collaboration with humans with these non-human entities?
That's a great question. Yes, there were lots of different things. First, when we would get there, and I say we again, because there were all kinds of, first of all, there were lots of different people being taken. And I get the question a lot, why didn't you talk to each other? When you're taken and when you're in their presence, it's like scrambles your brain and gives you what L.A. Marzulli likes to call UFO brain fog. Mm-hmm. And you don't think about things the way you normally would. And you don't react to things the way you normally would. It's almost like you're on a sedative or a tranquilizer and everything's a little bit scrambled. But I would get there and it was, you have to imagine like the biggest football field, airport, stadium, all these things put together, and underground, and it's massive. It doesn't feel claustrophobic. It doesn't feel tiny. It's huge. And then there are just systems of hallways and rooms and stairs and elevators. And it's so complex that I would never be able to even try to draw a map of it. It's just too big. And then there are some little areas that I could tell were very old, and my handler would take me into these areas once in a while, and they were like stone, like I felt like they were like old, like carved into stone type areas. Hmm. And those were really unique and interesting, but that's how I knew for sure we were underground.
So did you learn stuff? Did they do experiments on you? Did they try to teach you stuff? I mean, I know grooming is for, there was some you know, there was some human hybrid stuff going on down the road when you were older. But was this an education you were having, or was this something that you just complied with and wanted it to be over?
Right, right. No, there was some education going on as well, but it was more like a download of information more than anything else. And to get back, because I really didn't fully answer your question before, there were lots of different kinds of entities there, and there were humans there working alongside them. Wow. So I saw people in lab coats, people in weird sort of like smock and pants, almost like scrubs type outfits. But they were beige. They weren't like green or, you know, fanciful like you see in the hospitals. There were people that looked like in military type uniforms, but not just your typical type military uniforms. They were different. They didn't have the same kind of badges and things that you would see with our military. There were humans working alongside these different types of alien entities. And like the little grays that would come to get me, they were like cookie cutter. You know, those were just created, I think, so that if a ship crashes or they get captured, what are we going to get? An empty meat suit, right? No one's going to have anything there. And I've seen them empty just on the floor, like stacked over alongside of a wall. And I've heard that other people have reported that same thing as well. But there were reptilians, and my handler was a reptilian. He appeared as a man, but I noticed that he would kind of fuzz in and out sometimes, kind of like a holographic looking thing.
Yeah.
And I asked him, I want to see what you look like. I'm very curious. I won't be scared. I've seen all these things all over anyway. Why would I be scared? And he showed me his true form, and he was reptilian, but he wasn't ugly. He was beautiful. And, you know, his skin was almost like this iridescent, like opalescent, kind of almost bejeweled, not scaly gross. And his face was very large, very wide. His eyes were very large. He had a flat nose and kind of this line going up the center of his face. And it was different. He was just different, you know. But I think I had just come so accustomed to seeing these things that they no longer scared me the way they initially did. And there were the mantis or insect type entities. I did not like to ever get close to those. They always seemed to be across the room when I was little. I called those corner sitters because they always seemed to just be sitting in the corner of a room watching everybody, like in charge or something, maybe. I don't know. You know, they don't tell you what they're doing.
Yeah.
They don't share that information. They don't sit and say, you know, this is our rank and this is how it works.
Yeah.
What I find really interesting too is people tend to think that they all just look alike, like Marvin the Martian walking off of a spaceship or something. They all look different, like people do. They're all different. Like the regular grays that these little gray suits are fashioned after, some are really tall, some are really short, some are really robust and really just massive, and some are very petite and look feminine. You know, they have different facial expressions. Their faces all look different. Their eyes move, unlike the little grays. They may have faces that crinkle their foreheads and different expressions like people would.
Was there ever like a Satan-like or a evil commander type thing that you were ever heard of down there? And the humans that were there, were they subservient or were they partners down there? Did you get the feeling?
No, there was never any like, you know, big red horned caped Satan type creature lurking around.
No head honcho that, you know, everybody reported up
no,
to.
No, not that okay. I saw. No. And, you know, I wasn't that important. I mean, I was just a little human down there with hundreds of other little humans that they're doing stuff to. So they would tell me, you're very special. You're very important. That was part of the grooming process. But it didn't really mean anything. You know, I'm nobody to them. I'm a lab rat in a cage for all they care.
Yeah.
The humans were working there, and I don't know if some of them lived there or not. I kind of got the feeling that some of them did. But I know that the humans were threatened basically to be quiet. And I, you know, I never was allowed to talk to them. They weren't allowed to talk to me. And the UFO brain fog kind of kept me from even making a huge effort to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they used me and other abductees to show them. And I write about it in the book. It's very difficult to talk about. It was very difficult to write about, but I felt that it was important. And I do warn my readers in the book that if you're sensitive to these things, you might want to skip this part. And so I won't go into it in detail here, but they utilized me and said, you don't want this to happen to your family members, to your daughters, to your wives, to your friends. And I have a feeling that, and this is just conjecture on my part, but think about it. If you were working for a big tech company or something, or, you know, big aerospace company, and they're like, you're doing so great, we're going to give you top security clearance and put you on this special project, but you got to sign an NDA. And before you know it, you're in it, you know, and it's too late and you can't talk about it. And I know lots of people who have jobs they can't talk about.
It's like the it's like the Firm by John Grisham, that remember that old book from the 1990s or whatever.
Yeah, I never read it, but I've heard people refer to that when I talk about it.
He's in the firm and he can't get out. It's almost like a mafia aspect to it. But yeah,
that makes sense. No, and that's how I feel like it was for the people, and they're like, you know, they were reminded, you know, that you don't talk. And I get it. You know, there was a lot of coercion used against us and against me when I was little, and against the people there not to speak. And, you know, it makes sense why people don't speak, because I'm desperately protective of my family. And I understand someone being that way as well. So I don't hold any ill will towards anyone who had, you know, didn't help me.
Yeah.
You know, what could they do?
At what age, or when did the tide change where, forgive me for saying it, but it got sexual, you know, or it got very uncomfortable. It was almost, you know, rather than learning, you were giving probably for their needs,
right.
If it's okay to mention that.
No, that's fine. When I hit an age where I was fertile, that's when everything changed.
Okay.
And yeah, it was sick and twisted and wrong in so many ways. And it really affected every single part of my life. And it took me a lot of time to get through that and be able to have a normal relationship, which I do now, which is wonderful. But, you know, that was a really long, hard road for me and for a lot of others.
Were you awake? Did they try to mess with your mind where gave you almost soothing sensations that weren't real, tactile?
Yeah, from the time I was little, they had this way they could just put their hand like over my forehead or over my eyes, or touch my shoulder or my leg, and they could induce whatever feelings they wanted me to have.
God,
whether it was calm, or instead of crying and feeling pain, you know, the pain would stop if they were doing things with needles, you know, or if I was scared when I was little, they could make that fear go away temporarily, or to try to make you see something else instead of what's going on. And when I was little, after I had my little breakdown, that's when I realized there was nothing I could do, and I started disassociating from it, and I created this, you know, little world where when they would take me, I would just let my mind take me somewhere else. And then they didn't do a lot of the blocking of my memories because I wasn't even allowing myself to be there. And I think that might be why I remember so much. Although I will say I have spoken to dozens and dozens of people and gotten so many emails from people and messages from people who do remember their abductions, but they are, you know, terrified to ever say anything to anyone. And I'm probably the first person they've ever reached out to.
Now, and I know it could go really deep, you know, because you've had a lot of experiences with it. Go to the part two, if it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, how do you combat this thing? First, it's just you compartmentalize it. You go into your safe place. But at some point in your life, you did find religion, Christianity, and your faith in Jesus Christ and God. And could you explain how that door opened and then go on from that to where you learned how to use it as a tool to help you in these situations?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. So when I was in my late teens, my roommates and I were just listening to some music, and it was a Duran Duran song. And it was, my roommate says, they're talking about not going in the rapture. And we're all like, what's the rapture? We had no idea. You know, we went to church as kids, but I learned about things like Noah, and I knew about Jesus, but I didn't really know anything about Jesus. And so that night she got her Bible out, and we all learned all about Christianity and Jesus and his sacrifice for us. And we all gave our hearts and our lives to Jesus that night. And it was lovely. And you know, they stopped taking me for that period of time, for that kind of year or two, where I was in this learning phase and going to trying out different churches and trying to figure out where I was in my belief system and understanding that, you know, God loved me and I was protected. But I did not know the correlation between these non-human entities and God. So I didn't realize why they weren't taking me. I just thought, that God loved me enough and, you know, or maybe I was doing good now and that's why it stopped. No one talked about it. No one in a church talks about these things. So I had no idea. As I got married and went on with life and moved away and just fell away from my faith, I never forgot, but I fell away in a very big way and spent the next, you know, so years of my life not living a Christian or life or walking, you know, with God the way I live now, which is 100% imperfect. And that's how everyone is. And that's cool.
Yeah.
God doesn't expect us perfect, thank goodness. But so, you know, then when there's a thing that happened about 8 years ago where I had a near-death experience, which was amazing and beautiful and terrifying, the way that it happened.
You must have not wanted to come back after, you know, I would imagine. I mean, some people, I've talked to a couple people about that too, but yeah, it just...
At that point I did, you know, and the thing is, I mean, at that point I had a wonderful husband. I didn't have my grandchildren yet and I didn't know that they were on their way, but they actually were at that point. But that never entered my mind when it happened. It was a very traumatic way that it happened. I was in a hospital and I was given a paralytic instead of a sedative and there was no one around me. I was not hooked up to any machines or anything yet. This woman came in who was, I thought was my anesthesiologist. She pushed this paralytic into my IV port and I'm not hooked up to anything yet. It was just pre-surgery.
What is that? What is a paralytic? To paralyze you or is, I guess? Like yeah.
It is. Yeah, commonly during surgery, and this was a big one. I was having another back surgery. I've had many because of the things that have happened that are just unexplainable physical things. And I do have a whole section in the book about that and the government reports that back up everything that's happened to me. But a paralytic is commonly given at a point during the surgery when you have machines breathing for you.
Okay.
And you have, you're hooked up to everything and there's a person there watching you.
Yeah.
You know, so it paralyzes your body completely because when they're doing a spinal surgery, you know, they don't want to slip with that scalpel around your spinal cord.
Yep.
That's going to be the end, right? So, that would be something commonly given later in the process. But at this point, it was just supposed to be something to relax me while I waited for the surgeon. They had brought me into the operating room and he wasn't ready. And so I wasn't hooked up to anything and no one was watching me. There were a couple of nurses doing things in the room and they eventually noticed because I remember dying on the table. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't call out for help, feeling this old familiar scenario again, where I can't move and I can't cry for help, which is something I'd experienced my whole life. And here I am again. Mm. But this time it was different. You know, it wasn't a non-human entities taking me. This was my physical body dying. And I remember thinking, God, please help me. And in the blink of an eye, I was taken out of my body just in the blink of an eye. And suddenly I'm watching everything and I can see and hear everything. And I was still me. And I felt the most amazing, all-encompassing love and peace beyond anything I can ever describe. And I just knew instantly at that moment, everything I needed to know, God gave me. He's like, stay here with your body. You're going to go back in soon. You know, I knew I wasn't leaving, that this wasn't my death. This is just something that happened. Mm-hmm. So there was never a question of whether I was staying or going. And I just felt love and peace. There was no angst. There was no, I'm going to miss everybody. There was nothing like that. I could see what was happening in the other rooms of the hospital. I could hear my doctor. When the one nurse finally noticed that there was something wrong with me, she ran into the other room to grab him. And she was hysterical. And I saw him run out yelling to bag me and watched everyone run in, try to resuscitate me. As soon as they intubated me, that's when everything went black and I was back in my body.
Now, were there two... angelic-like beings that were when you were being brought back to your family, or am I remember this correctly? Or okay.
Yes, during my recovery after that surgery, when they tried to bring me out of anesthesia, it was so painful and so terrible, and I was screaming in pain. I don't know why, unless it was because I had been in such a beautiful, peaceful, painless place.
Can I tell you what an interpretation of that someone else said on a prior episode?
Yes, please.
It's a guy who came back and he was in immense pain and he remembered it was pain he'd had from all throughout his life, you know, from when you broke a thumb. As you go along in life, you forget those pains or you put it aside, you know, and it was almost like when he got back into his body again, he experienced all the pain from all the stuff that had happened to him through his life, and it took him a while to be able to numb that out. That's how he explained it.
That makes so much sense. Thank you for that, because yes, it was that. That is a very good description of how it felt. It was like every pain I'd ever felt. It was just so magnified, and they had to keep putting me under because they were afraid I was going to have a stroke or a heart attack.
Yeah.
Every time. So it was like 4 hours. I'd already been in surgery for like 7 hours. Now it's taking them like 4 hours in recovery. And so finally about 3.5 or 4 hours into it, I remember during that first moments where they brought me out of it going, please God, help me. And all of a sudden there were these two, I noticed these two young male orderlies standing at the foot of the bed. They were just wearing scrubs, just plain blue scrubs. And I looked at him, I'm like, you're so handsome. You look like you could be two of my boys, you know, because I have a lot of sons and they're about that age. And I'm like, oh, and one of them put his hand on my calf and I just suddenly felt calm. You know, the pain didn't bother me anymore. And I don't remember them actually verbally saying anything to me, but I remember talking to them and just jabbering on and on to them about, oh, you have to meet my boys. I bet you'd love them. And thank you so much. You've just calmed me down so much. I feel so much better. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Things a mom would say who's just going on and being appreciative and grateful. And so finally they're wheeling me up to my room and we get to the door of the room and I grab my husband and my daughter-in-law's hands. They were always there for me for these surgeries. And I'm like, you have to meet the boys. They remind me so much of our boys. And they're like, okay, yeah. And I look and they're not there. And so I asked the nurse and the other orderly who are beside me, what happened to the boys that were with us? And they didn't know who I was talking about. And I'm like, the boys, I was talking to them all the way up in the elevator, all the way down the hall. She's like, honey, it's just been the two of us. We wondered who you were talking to, you know, and she's laughing at me. She thought I was just delirious from the med.
Yeah.
Probably was a little bit, honestly, but you know, no one else saw them but me. I searched that hospital for that week that I was there, or 2 weeks. I can't remember. I think it was about 2 weeks that I was there. I had a walker. I had a stroke from that. And it was just a terrible.
Yeah.
But I didn't care. I wanted to find those boys. I don't think I would have got through it. And for me, that shows this stark difference between these beautiful, good, angelic beings and the ones who are fallen. Mm. You know, so there are really good, wonderful beings out there. And I love that people like to talk about the good ones because that's just wonderful. And I hope that that's what everyone gets when they get an angelic encounter.
Yeah.
The problem is we don't know what you're going to get. And the bad guys don't announce themselves, just like in our world. You know, the carjacker doesn't walk around with a sign saying, hey, I'm a carjacker, you know, or I'm going to rob you or pickpocket you or steal your purse or whatever. Or the bad guys don't walk around with those signs on them. So you just don't know what you're going to get. And that's what I caution people about is the deception.
Yeah, that's like the dichotomy of this, I don't know if that's the right word, of this podcast. I mean, I meet people who believe in reincarnation and people who think, nope, you only have one life. I meet people who think there are demons and evil and other people who think, no, I've never come across that. It's just because they, you know, they put themselves in that mindset and it comes to them. It's human driven or whatever. So. I have that like back and forth thing going on the 100+ episodes I've done on this show so far.
Right. Yeah. And you have such a great variety of people on, and I love that you embrace everyone's thoughts. And I like to approach the world that way as well, because I don't know that I'm right about everything. All I can tell you is what I've experienced and what's happened to me. And I don't disparage anyone who has different thoughts or feelings on it, because those are theirs and that's important. You know, I mean, for me, I've spoken to and emailed with and met just hundreds of people who've had the very similar circumstances to mine.
Yeah.
But I also understand there's many people who have different circumstances, and that's okay too. I wish for everyone to just have nothing but wonderful, good things happen. But I can't get behind saying that kidnapping little children, raping women, stealing fetuses, that kind of thing, mutilating humans and cows, that's benevolent behavior. So there's definitely some that are not benevolent, in my opinion.
Yeah. No. And also, thank you, because I mean, when I did the documentary, the same thing here with the podcast. This is just a platform to listen to stories and not judge, but just share it and see what we can come with an understanding and learn from. So
yeah,
that's kind of what I've tried to done through all the things on it. So you had this near-death experience. You came back And then I think in your timeline, there was a point where you went, maybe there was some postpartum stress or whatever, post-traumatic stress syndrome. You had to go get some help. And that's when a light bulb went out, how to navigate your faith to help you deal with this darkness that was in one part of your life.
That is, yes, that's very accurate. I had a lot of stress, post-traumatic stress after this happened, waking up, screaming at night, not being able to breathe. My husband, who is a certified EMT, among other things, it's not his job, but it's something he can do, had oxygen there beside the bed at the ready every night because I literally could not breathe, you know. And so I got therapy and learned how to just calmly deal with these very stressful situations. And that flowed into this lifetime of stressful situations. And I no longer had to cut them out and, you know, just pretend that I wasn't terrified every night when I went to bed. I can't walk, or I couldn't. I can now. I couldn't walk through a house at night alone or a dark house or look out the windows. I had to have light and I had to have someone with me, or I had to always have my phone or something, you know, once those came around, so that if something happened, I had, you know, some kind of safety. I mean, it just, the terror never leaves. This helped me deal with it, and it was amazing. And then throughout dealing with it, God just gently called me back to him. And it was just amazing, because after that near-death experience, I kind of went down a new age, more of a new age path. And I wasn't really fitting. I wasn't finding my fit. And then I found it, and I found my way back, and I found that my heart belongs to God. And that was the most wonderful experience, and that I don't have to be perfect. That was just great for me, because then I started to put all these pieces together.
And you literally, non-human entities came back after that, but you literally invoked the name of Jesus Christ as a deterrent, and it worked. I'd never heard anyone say that before. And apparently, I think you've talked to people who have, but that to me, that was very interesting, is that, which really kind of shows that it isn't just an alien entity, because everybody has their own religion, but it is, could be something else.
Absolutely. Yeah. So as I found my walk back into my faith again and understanding my creator, I realized, wait a minute, he's also their creator, right? So I was taken, and I'm like, you have the same creator I do, which means you have to answer to him. So he can protect me from you. So in Jesus' name, you have to let me go. And they just looked at me like, oh, shoot, she's figured it out. And yes, they kept trying to come back.
Wow.
Absolutely. They did not want to let me go. I learned a lot about the covenants, salt covenants, the threshold covenants, those kinds of things, especially from people like Vicki Joy Anderson later on, and that, you know, agreements are made, and it's a very legalistic place. You know, it's the world, the universe, everything in God's creation, there is order. It's very well ordered. But I've also talked to people, they're not born again Christians. They don't go to church. They're not particularly religious, but they are able to call on Jesus' name, and these entities leave and leave them alone. You don't have to be going to a specific church or believing in a specific religion or doing specific things. No, you just have to know who your creator is, and you have to understand that connection. You can feel it in your heart, or you can say it out loud. It still works. It's amazing. It's beautiful.
I haven't, you know, I'm guilty. I haven't really read the Bible, or, I mean, I've gone to church and I'm Catholic, and I do believe, and I always start every day with gratitude and thank my angels and Jesus and everything. But in the Bible, there is a lot of references, because people say, well, if there's aliens, why isn't it mentioned in the Bible? But I guess it does. I know you could probably spend an hour or two just talking about the Bible and some things that you learned, but what are two or three things that might surprise people that are in the Bible, that what you've learned that correlate to what's kind of happened to you and who these non-human entities are?
That's a great question. And I will tell you, in the book, I cover that all throughout the book, everything in the book. And I will tell you those things as well. But just if the listeners want more, I provide a lot of that in the book. And Elia Marzulli has some excellent books that cover that as well. There's so many, I could reference so many different amazing authors who have been so helpful to me in this. But for one, if you look at Genesis 6, where it talks about the sons of God, these are the angels, the angelic beings, the B'nai HaElohim, how they saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and took of them wives of all that they wanted. And they had children with them. And these were the Nephilim, the mighty men of old. Mm. And they were on the earth in those days of Noah's time and after that. And that is where these giants, the Nephilim, some were giants, some were tiny. You know, they were all different. They weren't all just giants. There's as many types of Nephilim as there are types of angels and people. So everyone kind of gets stuck on the giants, but that's not all there is. Things like that, where you, in the Bible, it talks about pillars of fire, chariots of fire. These are vehicles of conveyance for entities to travel in our world. Because again, it kind of goes back to that. We think that everything should fit into our world. And our world is just a little part of a vast universe created by God. So this is a unique situation where we live, but it's not everything. So there are so many wonderful descriptions of supernatural things in the Bible. Elie Marzulli calls it the guidebook to the supernatural. And I give him props for that because it really is. I always found the Bible so boring. And now I find it fascinating because now I read it and I'm seeing so much more. So I understand it can be boring for some people, but I do encourage you to give it a second look or look at it through someone else's eyes and kind of see there's some really amazing stuff in there.
Yeah, I think for me, it was just such a hard read. I mean, my father read the Bible, but it's hard when you kind of walk into a cold, you know? So yeah, it was difficult.
Don't read Leviticus then. No, yeah.
That's yeah. Hard. You know.
Right, but the Solomon is fascinating.
Yes, yes. I know there's different chapters I'll certainly have to flip to. In the notes I got on you, it mentioned two dates, Roswell in 1947 and the Granada Treaty of 1954. Why are those dates significant to you, and how does this align with the non-human entities that you've been exposed to?
Yeah. Oh, and I'm so sorry. That's a typo. It should be Griada.
Griada. Okay. Okay.
It always corrects itself, and I miss it all the time. And I'm so sorry about that. But yes, that. So those two dates are really significant to me. One, because most people have heard of Roswell, and that is the supposed crash and retrieval of a ship and its entities that were in it. And, you know, the first thing that happened is a newspaper headline splashed across that, you know, saucer crashes and victims were found. And then the next day, oh no, no, it was a weather balloon. And it shows this pattern of lying and covering up by our government officials that they don't want us to know the truth. And then you fast forward to 2017, where they're saying, oh, well, we do have those programs. We do have these projects. We have retrieved craft. We have retrieved non-human biologics. And, you know, this just keeps going on, and they're just trickling out this stuff to try to normalize it slowly. In the book, I have a report, and I provide the readers with a large portion of it that was released by the government in 2022, called, it has a long name, it's called Anomalous Acute and Subacute Field Effects on Human Biological Tissues. And it's talking about the traumas that people who have been exposed to these entities and their ships have experienced. Mm. And they have it cataloged, and they have all of the things that I've experienced in there, and they're admitting. And it was on Tucker Carlson and Fox News, and Brett Baer were saying, it sounds like something out of The X-Files or Twilight Zone, but it's real. The government's saying this now. But, you know, it was crickets. No one paid any attention to it. And so that's why I bring these things up. And the Griada Treaty was supposedly the first real time that agreements were made by our government and offshoot governments, you know, when the Majestic 12 and those types of groups came into being.
Is that Eisenhower? Yeah. Eisenhower?
Eisenhower, okay. When he went for his supposed dental emergency and was gone for 2 days. There's a huge amount of information out there that you can find. I included some of it in my book, but I didn't want my book to just repeat everything that has been covered so well by so many others. But it just shows this pattern of deceit and cover-up and lying. And it also shows where the government supposedly initially said, or the Majestic 12 and these off-government groups, that these entities had permission to take humans and animals for experimentation in exchange for technology. This is, again, something you can find in our Bibles they're the exact same types of agreements made with fallen angelic beings.
Mm.
And especially too, you go to ancient texts and extra canonical books like Enoch and Jasher. There's just so many amazing texts out there that to be explored that we aren't told about and you don't know are out there, but they're really amazing.
There's a gentleman that was on my guest. I forget his name and the name, but he wrote about that whole type of aspect with Eisenhower. He wrote a book on it. And he wrote a book because he wanted to read a book about it, and he couldn't find information. So he spent a lot of time researching, and he uncovered it, you know? So,
People have done a really good job. And yeah, his book and Ellie Marzulli's written a lot about that. There's so much good information out there, but you have to look for it. And, you know, it's just not put out with mainstream information. So it's considered too sci-fi or too strange or too out there. And it's really coming into our backyards more and more. I don't think it's going to be long before we see a lot more of these entities showing up.
I think one way they can learn about it is obviously buying and reading your book. Before we talk about where they can get that, you know, what's the end game? Are the non-human alien entities, what are they trying to do? Are they trying to hybrid? They want to be able to populate with us to have a reinforcements, you know, in the fight against God? Or do they want to corrupt our bloodline? Or what's going on with this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's a little bit of all of the above. The late Dr. Chuck Missler used to say, Satan's outnumbered 2-1. He's building an army. And I really think he is. I think that's the hybridization program.
Mm.
If you look at books like Dr. David Jacobs, who is a doctor of psychology, who wrote many books about people who had been taken and about the hybrid entities, one in particular called Walking Among Us. There's just so much about these hybrid entities. And I call them modern day Nephilim. It goes back to Genesis 6 when the fallen angels mated with humans, and it's still happening today. I also think that it's an opportunity for them to lead people away from the truth. A fallen entity is going to habitually be lying and deceptive and sharing false information. You know, they tried to tell me, well, we're just here to help. You know, we want to save your planet and we want to help you. And I'm like, then why are you doing these things to me?
Yeah.
And why am I still seeing you bringing little children in here? And why are you killing innocent, you know, human and animal mutilations? People hear about cattle mutilations.
Yep.
Some people don't. Some people do. But they also, that happens to humans as well. You don't hear much about that, but it does happen. It is documented. So I think it's multifaceted. You know, it's really two-sided. There's a good and there's an evil. And it's, I believe, an effort to get as many people onto the side of evil as possible, with or without them realizing they're doing it. The people themselves, not the evil ones.
Yeah, that's certainly going on. You don't even need hybrids to do that. I mean, a lot of people have really bad morals. Wanted to close with where people can get the book, or if you wanted to promote L.A. Marzulli's website or anything else. If someone listened to this podcast and said, oh my God, someone finally gets it, is there a website they could go to, or how might they share their story?
Yes, I absolutely encourage anyone to reach out to me, please. I hear that a lot every day. At least one new person emails me saying, I finally feel like I'm not alone.
Wow.
And I am so grateful for that, because I remember the moment when I first met the people that Ellie Marzulli introduced me to, who were in the movie with me, and I was no longer alone. And that was just one of the most amazing moments of my life, because I had comfort. There is comfort in not being alone. So please reach out to me. The easiest way to reach out to me is through email. There's a contact form on my website. My website is my name, KarenWilkinsonAuthor.com, and I'll give you all this for show notes. You can also email me directly at stolenseed@yahoo.com. Just the first part of the book, stolenseed@yahoo.com. The book is available exclusively currently at lamarzulli.net. That's lamarzulli.net. So lamarzulli.net will take you to his store. You can link to that through my website. You can find me on social media under my name, Karen, K-A-R-I-N, Wilkinson with I's, W-I-L-K-I-N-S-O-N. Please reach out to me. You can message me on social media. it does take me longer to get back to you that way because I get so much spam in there, but I do try to sort through it at least once a week to find the real messages. But I do encourage you to reach out to me via email, through my website. That's the easiest way. I will get back to you. It may not be right away because there are some weeks where I just get dozens a day. So it's very important to me. And I do read every email that I get. And I will get back to you if you ask me to.
And in closing, do you think the takeaway is we need awareness and communication is a needed step to battle this type of thing? What do you think is the most important things people should be aware of and do?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to share the truth about what's really going on. There's a lot of false information out there from well-meaning folks, especially even in the Christian realm, who are not sharing the. I think we need to make sure we're getting the right facts. I'm not saying I'm always right. I'm saying, you know, read different things, listen to different people, check out different avenues and different information. Find what works for you. But what we need to do is get to the bottom line and get to the truth. For me, the truth is these are fallen angelic beings. They're not, you know, little green men coming from Mars. This is something completely different. They're powerful, they're strong, and they're dangerous. And you got to be careful because you don't know if you're going to get a good one or a bad one. I pray you get a good one because the good ones are wonderful. I can vouch for that personally, you know. But it's the truth. The truth is the most important thing that needs to be out there.
Well, I thank you for your time tonight, Karen. And I appreciate it. It's fascinating talking to you. And I'm assuming things are better for you now, correct? You're happy and your family's safe and everything's going well for you right now?
Yes, I know how to protect myself and my family from the things in the unseen realm and from the things in the seen realm. And I am just so grateful for the love and support that I've received doing this. I mean, you get a lot of pushback and a lot of unfriendly comments when you step out and talk about things like this. And so I appreciate anyone who has the bravery to do this, to talk about these things, and especially you for sharing these things, because it's something that needs to happen more.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure to have you on tonight. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. I had a wonderful time and I hope I'll get to meet with you again.
That'd be great.
Been listening to the Afraid of Nothing podcast. Please subscribe and like us on Facebook. Until next time, stay scared.
Hey, you're still here? Great. Then why not listen to another episode? Visit afraidofnothingpodcast.com to peruse all the shows. That's afraidofnothingpodcast.com. And while you're there, click the coffee cup icon to buy me a coffee and leave a review. I'll give you a shout out in an upcoming episode, and the world will know how swell you are.